that you have heard so far, and I'm not just talking about today, I'm talking about the week, months, years, decades. Please consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station by calling 212-209-2950 or go to givetowbai.org online. That's 212-209-2950 or go to give to the number 2 WBAI.org online. And one more thing before we go into this program. I'm pretty sure Imhotep is listening right now, so I'm just saying on behalf of people here at WBAI, the staff, as well as management in the air, wish you a very happy birthday. You deserved it. You deserve it. You've been at it for a long, long, long time. I'm not going to go too much into details because my father is listening and he gets jealous every time I say something about Imhotep Gary Bird. So I'm not going to do that. So, oh man, the call is going to be awkward tonight. Anyway, stay tuned for Open House coming up. I laugh sometimes to keep me from crying. But anyway, stay tuned for Open House coming up.
Open House from Poets House on listener-supported WBAI 99.5 FM, streaming live on WBAI.org. I'm your host, Cornelius Eady, and I'm excited to welcome guest poet Francisco Aragon to our show. Francisco is the son of Nicaraguan immigrants. His books include After Reuben, The Glow of Our Sweat. He is also the editor of The Wind Shifts, New Latino Poetry 2007. His work has appeared in over 20 anthologies. A native of San Francisco, he's on the faculty of the University of Notre Dame's Institute of Latino Studies, where he teaches courses in Latinx poetry and creative writing. He also directs the literary initiative Letras Latinas, a finalist for Split This Rock's Freedom Plow Award for Poetry and Activism. He has read his work widely. Francisco, welcome to our show.
Good to see you, Cornelius, after all these years. I know that we were colleagues at Notre Dame for 5 years, so this seems like a homecoming of sorts for both of
us. Yes. Yes. It's really great to see you too and to talk to you. There's so much I want to talk to you about. So let's talk about the story of your work as a poet and your work with Letras Latinas.
Sure. My origin story, if you will, with Letras Latinas starts at doing my MFA at Notre Dame between 2001 and 2003. And I was lucky enough to be hired upon completing my MFA to join the staff of the Institute for Latino Studies. And at the time, there was no literary component to the Institute, so I was charged with creating one. And one of the first projects I worked on was helping establish a first book prize for Latinx poets. The prize is named after the late Chicano poet, Andres Montoya. And at the time, my model for creating that prize was the Cave Canem Prize. So a story I like to repeat often whenever I have the opportunity to is that I was mentored by the person running Cave Canem at that time. We're talking 2003, and that would have been Carolyn Micklin, your mother-in-law.
Yes.
And I forget how I got her phone number. Somehow I got her email address. And we set up a series of they were basically phone tutorials on how to start a book prize. And I just picked her brain and asked her all the questions I could think of. And for example, one of the things that came out of those conversations was my decision to opt for having the prize be every other year rather than every year. But I'll never forget how instrumental it was to get her encouragement and practical advice on the nuts and bolts of running a first book prize. And from the first book prize, we began other initiatives. We had an initiative called Poetas y Pintores, Artists Conversing with Verse. I had a small press that I founded in California called Momotombo Press, which I eventually incorporated into our portfolio of things. And we published chapbooks by Latinx poets and prose writers. And we've just been doing that work coming on now 20 years. There was a parenthesis in there between 2007 and 2012. We moved our operations, Letras Latinas moved its operations to Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. I had an office in the University of California building, but now I'm back on campus and we're about to start planning our 20th anniversary. But one of the most ambitious things we did in the last year, which we'll be talking about during the 20th anniversary celebration, is a two-day conference that we had called Afro-Latinx Poetry Now. And we invited six poets and six scholars for 2 days of activities. And it was just quite remarkable to hear these poets not only read their own work, but give 20-minute talks on a poet of their choosing who they admired. That gave us the impetus to begin to map out what's going to be our 20th anniversary year. And the way we're going to celebrate it is we're going to be partnering with organizations for a constellation of events throughout calendar year 2024.
Well, congratulations on the 20th anniversary. Thank you for mentioning Carolyn. Just died recently, the day after her 90th birthday in December. Carolyn is one of the unsung literary heroes out there because of her sense of connection, not only to your group and the Kavikana, but also to Kundiman at their beginning. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Not a lot of people know that she was behind the scenes for a lot of these organizations. I also love the idea of your sense of activism. Sometimes there's this idea that poetry and activism doesn't go together, but the way you're expanding it, the way you're bringing people in to actually talk about, you know, the poets that have come before them and inspired them, I think is really commendable. So how does activism work for you?
It helped, you know, working for a place like the Institute for Latino Studies provided a very good and compelling context. The mission of the Institute is to illuminate the Latinx experience in the U.S. And so since my corner of the pie was the literary, when I took on the job in 2003, I began to sort of survey the landscape and see where are we being represented in the field, in Poetry Magazine, in Paris Review. And what I began to notice early on was that we weren't being represented. we were invisible.
Yes.
And so the activism emerged from a state of erasure and invisibility. And in that regard, you and Kaveh Khanum pointed the way of what that looks like in terms of, you know, fighting the good fight and starting to get results in this area, one relationship at a time. You know, one of the things I took away from my mentoring, from my being mentored by Carolyn, was that making progress in these areas of trying to gain space for our storytellers and poets, it starts with one relationship at a time. Mm. So activism, I think one of the things I would say is activism starts with relationships, one relationship at a time, and trying to build those alliances as we've done with various organizations.
Mm. I agree with you in terms of having to make a space or to insist upon a space in terms of representation. I was talking to my graduate class here at University of Tennessee, and I'm talking about this idea about how people like June Jordan, for example, or how people like Langston Hughes in his essay "The Negro and the Negro Poet and the Racial Mountain" was trying to make that insistence, you know, for inclusion of our voices, of where we come from and what we know about and what we bring to this culture. And I was thinking as an example of just what was missing back in my days when I was teaching in the Poets in the Schools program back in the 70s. They had this anthology called Sleeping on the Wing or Sleeping on the Wind that Kenneth Coach edited with some other people. And it was a fantastic anthology at the time. And I brought up this, I started rereading the anthology, which I hadn't touched in decades. The anthology is like, you know, new criticism poetry, right? You know, all the
all the usual suspects are in there. And it's a great anthology. But there's no, the only African-American, I believe, was Amiri Baraka. There were two women, and one of the women was Emily Dickinson. Right. So, isn't like, and I'm not trying to denigrate Canada Kutch. I mean, it was a fantastic anthology. It did its job, right? But it was coming from this idea of what was status quo, and it wasn't us, you know. So
we weren't included. We were sort of invisible. Yeah.
And this is why, not being represented in publishing, not being representative on campuses, not being representative, day to day is also why, Kaveh Khanum started to come into existence as a response to that. Why you jumped off from us, and why Kuhneman did the same thing. It's all this idea, you have to insist upon it. And also, besides insisting upon it, you have to figure out a way of making it work.
Doing this for 20 years, the challenge is finding those people who are willing to collaborate with you. My experience is sometimes people will say all the right things, will nod their head and agree with you, but then they don't follow up.
Right.
And so it's key. Letras Latinas exists because I encountered people who followed up with me, and I have a handful of people that I can name who have been very crucial collaborators, both within the Latinx mm-hmm. community and outside the Latinx community. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But sometimes, unfortunately, you do encounter people who play lip service to what you're trying to do, but then they don't follow up.
Right.
So you have to find those allies who will actually sit at the table with you and brainstorm a program.
Right. Yeah. And hang with you. I mean, that's really the important thing. Another experience I've had, is that basically it's the people who try it, and then when they hit a speed bump, they're gone. Right. To hang, you know,
for me, one of the highlights, for example, of our relationship with Kaveh Khanum was that year. I think it was 2010, where I pitched to you and then you pitched to Toy and others. The idea of bringing Brenda Cárdenas
to your
retreat to start dialogues between our two communities. And I remember Brenda and I just had a magical week in Pittsburgh, and she brought with her like 50 copies of her books and sold all of them.
Yes. Yes.
And Brenda's about to come out with her second book, next in the spring with Red Hand Press, another ally who I've been working with for many years. But that was a highlight, having Brenda in Pittsburgh.
Oh, I remember that week. You're absolutely right. That was an incredible week. It was an incredible week. But the fellows were like, good, you're acknowledging it, right? Right? You're acknowledging that's in there, right? That some of us are Latinx as well. I mean, we have to, you're acknowledging that, and I thought that was an absolutely perfect move, right? For Kaveh Khanum to do, to partner up, to actually ally, in partnership, that's what I mean. It changes it in wonderful ways. It strengthens both organizations. And of course, I mean, we're talking about this on a show that's being, sponsored by Poets House, right? So of course, Poets House, of course, has been a long time ally, for Kaveh Khanum, for also, all the other organizations. And it's one of those things where, to go back to one of the origin stories for Carolyn, Carolyn was the person that, insisted that we leave from Charlottesville, where Carolyn was, directing Kaveh Khanum from her second bedroom in Charlottesville, to go up to New York, to Soho. And once we got there, Toy and I were very kind of reluctant about doing that. We didn't know there'd be too much for us to handle. But she was insistent upon it. Once we talked it through, we went up there. When we finally got into Soho on Spring Street, we knew exactly why she did this, that we had to be a player at the table. But Poets House was the location that really, the organization that reached out and let us have the space to do our workshops.
Well, my analogy to that is that in 2007, when we relocated to Washington, D.C., being in Washington, D.C. between 2007 and 2012 allowed me to partner with Rob Casper at the Library of Congress.
Ah, yes.
Allowed me to partner with Terry Cross Davis at the Folger Library.
Yes, yes.
Allowed me to partner with E. Carmen Ramos at the Smithsonian Museum for an event that we did on poetry and art. So yes, it did make a difference being geographically in DC. And I think we went between 2007 and 2012 was when Letras Latinas went to the next level, because we were in Washington, we were able to establish those relationships. And it was very easy for me to take the bus up to New York and meet Paul Romero, who was curating the Bryant Park reading series. And that established that relationship. So yeah, that was really key.
Yes.
For Latin Latinas.
But yeah, and you're absolutely right. Again, it's that one-on-one connection. Being available, being around, and being able to make those connections. You have been so great at doing this, yeah, Francisco. I mean, just a lot of heavy lifting, but you really have pulled off quite a remarkable feat, and you should be congratulated for that.
Thank you, Cornelius.
And musician Cornelius Seedy. You're listening to Poets House, open house, and listener supported WBAI 99.5 FM, streaming live on WBAI.org. Welcome back to our show. Now we're going to hear some more work from poet Francisco Aragon. Francisco, what would you like to read?
The poem I'm going to share is called Ernesto Cardenal in Berkeley. And the story I want to tell about this poem, both its subject matter, but also the craft of the poem. Well, the subject of the poem is that when I was in 11th grade in high school, one day I played hooky. And instead of going to school, I went to Berkeley to hear Ernesto Cardenal read his poetry. And I found out about that reading because I had been on the campus the week prior and I saw a flyer on a telephone pole. And so that day I went to hear him read. And it was a transformative experience because I was 16 years old. Oh, this would have been 1982 or so. Yes. And I carried that story with me for many, many years. Fast forward to 1998, 2000. I'm a graduate student at UC Davis. And I was in a workshop with Sandra McPherson. And she encouraged us to try this idea of identifying a poem by someone else. Mm-hmm. Whose rhetorical strategy or grammatical strategy you really like, mm-hmm. take that poem, empty it of its content words, keep the vessel, and then pour your own content words into that vessel as a way to start your poem.
Oh,
and Ernesto Cardenal in Berkeley started that way. And the vessel was a poem titled 16 by the poet August Kleinzeller, in which he tells the story of forgetting to do his Latin homework on his way to Horace Mann High School. And it's a beautiful poem. And I thought maybe this could be the poem that will give me the structure I need to tell my story. And this is the poem. Uh-huh. The one thing I'll say about it is I make reference to a Francisco Hernandez de Cordova. He's the Spanish explorer who allegedly discovered Nicaragua. And I mentioned the Nicaraguan poet Rubén Darío, which I'll talk about later in a couple of other poems. But here's the poem. Ernesto Cardenal in Berkeley. And I'll say one more thing. The second half of the poem, the speaker is trying to imagine what his life would have been like had his parents decided not to migrate from Managua to San Francisco. Ernesto Cardenal in Berkeley, 1982. The books in my backpack felt lighter walking down the stairs at 24th and Mission. The sky was clear and I wasn't heading for school. Above, at the station's mouth, a preacher wove Spanish while beyond him, on the ground, a whiskered man snored through the morning, his trousers soiled. A thought flickered, swayed Rubén Darío in Madrid as I rode east along the floor of the bay. Commuters dozed, later did crosswords going home, more of them boarding at Embarcadero. Montgomery how, after the reading, I was a notebook filled. Mama y papa juntos, a different life billowing inside me. A dusty street in Granada or León playing baseball. Or picturing in class how Francisco Hernández de Córdoba is led across the plaza he himself had traced out with his sword. Beheaded. So it's a poem in which the speaker again is imagining his parents not migrating to California and being in a history lesson in Nicaragua and learning about one of Nicaragua's forefathers who himself had a violent demise. But again, it's a poem that...
I love the idea of number one, playing hooky, which I've always thought this is really a wonderful thing for poets to do. Poets are playing, I guess, in some ways, playing hooky anyway in their lives. But it's also this idea of this interaction with an older poet, right? You make me think of the time I actually met Michael Harper.
Mm.
And I was not much older. I must have been 17, mm-hmm, maybe.
Mm-hmm. I was in a
summer workshop at the University of Rochester, my mm-hmm. hometown. Mm-hmm. I got a scholarship to attend the class. Michael Harper had just written his first book, Dear John Jericho Train. Mm. And was teaching the workshop, and I had that kind of feeling that you had, mm-hmm. right? That you were entering into something larger that you weren't expecting.
And at the time, I was 16. I had no idea I was going to be writing poetry. I just was very fascinated with being the son of Nicaraguan immigrants. I was following how the revolution was going. I heard about this guy named Ernesto Cardenal. I couldn't read or write Spanish at the time, so I was actually reading it. I could understand it and I could speak it, but I couldn't read it or write it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was reading him in English, but I went to hear him and I was able to hear him read his poems in Spanish, and then his translator would read the translation in English. But it was just a mesmerizing experience being a 16-year-old in this jam-packed Wheeler Auditorium on the Berkeley campus, and then taking the BART train back to San Francisco and... which is when I'm trying to sort of chronicle in the poem what's going on in this young speaker's head as he's thinking about his own identity and Nicaragua and what would have happened if my parents had not migrated, you know?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. The alternate history of who you might have become otherwise. It was made me think also of what would have happened if my parents hadn't migrated from Florida, for example, up to the East Coast. I never thought of that until I encountered your poem. What would have happened if they had stayed? Would I have, ended up in a room with Michael Harper? Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. That's a fascinating what if.
Yeah. And in the poem, I do include, obviously the initial impetus was that experience, but then when it came to crafting the poem, I had to decide, what am I going to put in the poem? And so that little element, a thought flickered, swayed, and that thought is, Rubén Darío, the Nicaraguan poet, spent a good part of his adult life outside Nicaragua, including in Argentina, but also in Madrid, Spain. And so that was a way of sort of cueing in on the fact that this poem is about not only about a childhood memory or adolescent memory, but it's a poem also about literary lineage. Yes. You have Ernesto Cardenal in the title of the poem.
Yes, yes.
You have Rubén Darío in a little parentheses snippet in the middle of the poem as another nod to literary lineage.
Yes. I sometimes tell this to my students that when you start to enter a workshop, that's what you're doing. You're entering into a conversation with literature, right? And that's a great example of that, of you acknowledging that. You are now conscious of the fact that you as the older speaker, that this is where the first footsteps happened. or, you know, with where the possibilities became, you know, something that rose to your conscience, to the top of your consciousness, that you're in something. Right. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I love the way the poem talks about that. Lovely poem. So what happened afterwards?
Well, I continued to be fascinated by Nicaragua. In high school, I was interested in writing, but I wasn't sure I was going to be a poet. My origin story of why poetry.
Yeah.
I think you'll appreciate this. I was a sophomore at UC. So here, there I am as a 16-year-old. And then 2 years later, I'm on the campus as a student. And I'm deciding, okay, what classes am I going to take if I want to write? And there was an introduction to fiction writing. And there was an introduction to poetry writing. And so I submitted, and in those days, you know, there was more supply, there was more demand than supply. So mm-hmm. you had to submit a writing sample to get into an introductory course on poetry and fiction. So I submitted a writing sample to the fiction class, and I submitted a writing sample to the poetry class, open to doing whoever accepted me. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the fiction class rejected me, and the poetry class accepted me. And the poetry class was taught by Ishmael Reed.
No.
Ishmael Reed was my first poetry teacher in 1985. And because Ishmael Reed saw my writing and said yes, I got to take a poetry class with him. And that's my origin story. That's why it's poetry and not fiction.
Yes. Yes. It's almost like a coin toss, right? Right, right, right.
Yeah.
You got to tell me about this.
And what was the class like? It was in that class where I discovered the work of Victor Hernandez Cruz, who at the time was a mailman in Lake Merritt. And Ishmael invited him to class. Seated on our class, and that's where I met Ishmael Reed for the first time. It was in Ishmael Reed's class where I was first introduced to the work of Gary Soto, for example. Mm-hmm. And so it was in some ways, speaking of activism, it's when I began to first get a glimpse, without really knowing it, what literary activism looks like in terms of exposing your students to a wide mosaic of writers and not just the usual suspects.
Yeah.
And so in some ways, I sort of credit Ishmael Reed for subtly informing me that there is this thing called Latino poetry, Chicana poetry, because he was teaching it to his writing students and bringing, you know, the Victor Hernandez Cruz anecdote is so key because that's what led me to working for the Berkeley Poetry Review. And one of the last things I did for that magazine was that I went to interview Victor Hernandez Cruz, and we published a nice extensive interview with him in Berkeley Poetry Review because I got to meet him in Ishmael Reed's class. And he was just about to move back to Puerto Rico, to Aguas Buenas. I was in his Lake Merritt apartment with all his boxes getting ready to move. And all that happened because of Ishmael Reed.
Wow. Wow. Fantastic story. And there you have it, right? I mean, that's where you suddenly realize that, you know, there is, you know, that starts the journey, right? And I agree with you. It's, you know, I think part of the reason that, I am so, concerned about, making sure that my students are aware of activism, is because of what's going on around us right now with the AP, African American, you know, things going on where people are actually, intentionally removing poets, right? Mm-hmm. Right. If we don't read those poets, you'll never know who they are. Think of what would happen if Ishmael did not do that for you.
One thing I do want to add, because to complete this story, because UC Berkeley was such a crucial place to be at that time, also on the campus at the same time was Robert Pinsky and Tom Gunn.
Wow.
And it was through Robert Pinsky and Tom Gunn that I became acquainted with other lineages. Mm-hmm. So one of the results of being on a campus with Ishmael Reed on the one hand, Tom Gunn on the other, mm-hmm. and August Klein. I met while I was in Berkeley, but because I was on that campus and I had exposure to these different aesthetics and sensibilities, I had a very rich and eclectic group of poets to read. I was admiring people like Victor Hernandez Cruz and Gary Soto. But through Tom Gunn, I was also being exposed to Robert Duncan, And I was also being exposed through Ron Lowenson, the work of Michael Palmer. And so right away I always talk about this in the mid 80s, I was exposed to the various poetries that existed. And so my aesthetic sensibilities were quite wide ranging and not necessarily focused on just one lineage.
Oh, absolutely.
And I credit that because I was on that campus and I was exposed to many different sensibilities.
Yes, yes. I totally agree with that. But I mean, so many of us have the same story, right? Or similar story, right? You become aware of the fact that you fit within a larger context. And I think using the term poetries is really the right way of doing this.
Yeah.
Right. And even though I knew I'd never be writing like Basil, right? I was grateful to understand that sensibility, right?
Yeah.
It didn't turn into, I hate them and I can't. I mean, it's like, this is really an interesting, person. This is fascinating. I don't do this, but I'm fascinated by this and I'm glad to be exposed to it. It's the exposure that I think that people are trying to break up right now, right? With the APs, right? Right. So you don't have that wide a range. Of exposure or possibility of different voices. You're listening to Open House on Poets House on Listener Supported WBAI 99.5 FM, streaming live on WBAI.org, Cornelia Seedy. And you're listening to the work of our wonderful guest, Francisco Aragon. We'll get into the craft and the journey that led in here, and we'll listen to some more work.
Shall I read another poem?
Yes, please.
Okay, so that poem I read earlier comes from my book, After Ruben, and Ruben is reference to Ruben Darío. And one of the projects of this book is bring into English some of Rubén Darío's poetry. And so I want to share with your listeners a couple of poems. One that's sort of like a version of a Rubén Darío poem, and another one which takes Rubén Darío's poem and transposes it to the present. So this is called The Inevitable, and it's a rewrite of a Rubén Darío poem. The inevitable. I envy that tree. It barely feels. Envy even more this stone that hasn't felt for ages. Tell me of an affliction more acute than breathing, of something worse than knowing that we are, yet knowing nothing, unsure of which path to take, and what to make of this sense we're on a wheel, uncanny hunch of bleaker things to come, the only truth, one day we die. We endure this life, shadows what we ignore and hardly suspect, skin that glows like a shimmering piece of fruit, visions of a wreath beside a tomb, all the while without a clue of where we began, where we go. After Rubén Darío's Lo Fatal. The second poem I want to share takes a Rubén Darío poem whose original title was A Roosevelt, meaning to Roosevelt, meaning Teddy Roosevelt. Hmm. And it's perhaps Rubén Darío's most political, possibly his only political poem. It's a critique of the U.S.'s foreign policy in the Americas. And I was so intrigued by the poem and its rhetorical strategy that I thought, what if I rewrite this poem in English, but transpose it to the present day? And instead of having my poem addressing Teddy Roosevelt, have my poem addressing the person occupying the White House at the time. And so my poem is called To George W. Bush, circa 2006. Should I quote the good book you claim to know? Or perhaps our late bearded bard, might these be ways of reaching you? Primitive, modern, simple, complex, one part wily, astute animal, three parts owner of a ranch. Conglomeration is what you are, poised for another incursion. Lean, strong specimen of your breed, polite, you hardly read when not in a saddle or spreading manure. You see a building in flames as vital, progress a spewing volcano. And where you point and place your bullet, you stake the future, yours and ours. And so, not so fast. Oh, there's no doubting the heft of this nation. It moves, it shifts. A tremor travels down to the tip of the continent. You raise your voice and it's bellowing, we hear. The sky is mine. Stars in the east, sun in the west. People are clothes, their cars, Sunday attire at church, a harbor lady lighting the journey with a torch. But America, sir, is north, central, and south. Delicate wing of a beetle, thundering sheet of water. Our cubs are crossing over. And though, O man of bluest eye, you believe your truth, it is not, you are not, the world. After Rubén Darío's A Roosevelt.
Oh.
So in that poem, I'm basically transposing Darío's rhetorical strategy and bring it to the present day and tweaking it and making it a poem addressed to them.
Yes. Beautiful strategy. And it worked so, works so well. Let's talk about the political poem a little bit, right? Right. There's some people out there that believe that the political poem is, there's no place in poetry. It's not, you know, you're losing, something when you decide to make the subject matter something political. But you just again showed us, these listeners, just how incredibly rich a mind this is, right? And how the different strategies actually bringing this, you know, connecting these two eras together. Right. To actually make us aware of that, that continuity. Right. It's political, but it's also a beautiful poem. Right. And also has this, it has this incredible sense of invention, to it, to recraft it in such a way that lets us see both of those voices.
Yeah. Crafted and also trying to come up with language that engages your reader. I mean, getting back to how I was influenced in Berkeley, it was in Berkeley when I first encountered the work of Robert Duncan and the work of Denise Levertov. And I look at their work on the Vietnam War.
Yes. Yes.
Was a model in terms of how can you write a poem about something like that, but at the same time, an aesthetically pleasurable experience for the reader.
Yes.
The language itself is approaching, you know, song as opposed to just, you know, a political tract.
Right. It's not the material isn't poetic. It's how you do it, how you turn it. Right. Yeah. That's your, that I think is the challenge to the poet. You know, and you can, and clearly you can rise to it. You know, you clearly you can find ways in to make it, you know, resonate in the way that you just did. Just a gorgeous, gorgeous poem.
Speaking of activism, one of the activist gestures in this book is queering Rubén Darío. Mm-hmm. The poem I'm about to read speaks for itself. It starts with a head note. In November of 2012, Arizona State University issued a press release announcing the acquisition of a privately held collection of manuscripts created by Nicaraguan poet Rubén Darío. The collection consists of 900 or so handwritten pages of poetry, essays, stories, and personal letters, nine of which revealed for the first time an intimate relationship between Darío and famed Mexican poet Amado Nervo. Shortly after ASU made its announcement, the Nicaraguan novelist Sergio Ramírez published an article in which he denounced the letters as fake. This is a poem in the voice of Rubén Darío from the grave to Sergio Ramírez, titled January 21st, 2013. Which happens to be the day that Richard Blanco read his inaugural poem at Obama's inauguration. Dear Sergio, your depiction in Margarita, How Beautiful the Sea, of my homecoming to León in 1907, once again filled my arms with bouquets that dampened my silk suit, baskets of flowers and fruit, which I accepted with a nod, though leaving them in the hands of my entourage. A cambric handkerchief wiping the sweat dripping down my face and neck. And as I opened a path for myself, village folk pressing around, their lips at my sleeves, a little boy with curly hair led the way, clutching the flag of Nicaragua. I loved how you had Momotombo years later in 1916, blow. Moments after I drew my last breath, the volcano producing a deep rumbling, sending people into the streets, a spatter of sparks lighting the sky. I wasn't aware, of course, of what came next, your novel placing me there in that room, the doctor's scalpel blinking like a star. In the moment it traced the incision on my forehead, my scalp folded back, the saw's fine teeth biting into cranium, he feverishly snipping ligaments, holding in his hands my brain, seconds later proclaiming, here it is, the private vessel of the muses. More than cringe, I blushed at being handled with such care. Perhaps you're surprised by this letter? You shouldn't be. Anything is possible in this racket of hours. But artful is not how I describe that piece you penned last November. You see, those letters to Amado were real. I bargained with myself, rewrote them, to preserve them precisely because I knew what would happen. You know, as well as I, he would have destroyed them after reading them. What will people say? He, with wife and children, held sway. I was in New York shortly after New Year's in 1915, heading home when I wrote to him one more time. But you were right, and I'm mildly embarrassed to admit it. I told a little lie on those sheaths of Hotel Astor stationery in Times Square. The poem I enclosed wasn't composed in Barcelona expressly for him. It was a piece of juvenilia, I know, but one I had a soft spot for, and which I retitled and dedicated to him. It was a running joke between us, sending each other our fluff. And yet, it's ironic, Sergio. Thank you for being complicit, for hinting at my understory. How did you manage to nail those final hours? I was indeed lying curled up on my side, wrapped in a thick gray blanket, snoring lightly, my mouth slightly open as my fingers gripped the silver crucifix that Amado, yes, Amado Nervo, had given to me in Paris when we shared that apartment in Montmartre, and that I always carried with me. I'd like to think that somehow you knew and know this truth. I'm waiting for the day when you, the world, stop fighting it. I am dead, and the dead are very patient. Love, Ruben.
Gorgeous.
So the other strand in this book is the queering of Ruben Dario.
Mm-hmm.
And when that news came out in 2012, it caused me to reconsider some of the versions of his poems to incorporate this new biographical data that we now have about Ruben Dario. And that's another form of activism, I think.
Yeah, yes.
And that is correcting the record or refusing to be silenced, you know, when people try to sort of say, oh, no, this person wasn't this way. You know, say, well, the record seems to indicate that he was.
I call it filling in the blanks, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I've never heard a better interpretation of rolling around in your grave. And I love the way you feel free to simply say, now I can reinterpret. See, now that I have this information, now I can reinterpret what's happening. And I'm going to reinterpret, right?
Ian Gibson did something very similar with Garcia Lorca. After the scandal died down and everyone accepted that Garcia Lorca was gay, Ian Gibson went back and reread all of Lorca through a queer lens and then wrote a book about Garcia Lorca, revisiting all his work with this information that we know about.
The information broadens beyond the understanding of the artist, right? You know, so it's really a wonderful to have to hear the poem, to hear the strategy for the poem. I'm glad you read that one because it just also sort of, again, it's like, this is what we're up to these days, right? I think that the work that we're up to these days is exactly that, trying to make sure that you understand, filling in stuff that we couldn't get when we were poets in the 70s, right? And the 80s, right? The stuff that was really resisted and we needed to insist upon. You need to know this, to know about this writer. You need to understand that this person inhabited many communities, right? Right? That you need to understand that, to understand it, but also understand that that's also part of our literary heritage here, right? That's
absolutely
also part of who we are, makes us who we are. So it's a wonderful retort. I just think rolling around in the grave. if the poet could roll around in the grave and had a pen and some paper, right, that's what they do, right?
Yeah.
Gorgeous poem. I'm your host, Cornelia Seedy, and you're listening to Open House from Poets House on listener-supported WBAI 99.5 FM, streaming live on WBAI.org. Welcome back to the show. We've been chatting with Francisco Aragon, poet, educator. We're going to be winding down doing something we asked our guests to do, to read a poem by another poet. Francisco, what have you selected for us?
The poems that I've read so far all have a connection to Nicaragua. And the poem that I want to share with your listeners by someone who's not me is a poet named Leon Salvatierra. Mm. He just published a beautiful book called To the North, Al Norte. Leon lives in Berkeley, but he migrated to the U.S. when he was like 16 years old from Nicaragua. He went on to do a PhD in Spanish literature at UC Berkeley. His dissertation was on Rubén Darío. And then he did an MFA at UC Davis and now teaches in the Chicano Studies Department at UC Davis. But he actually published this book in Nicaragua in Spanish first. And then when he was living in the U.S., he befriended the Chicano poet Javier O. Huerta. And so the poem I'm going to read to you now is an English translation from the Spanish of Leon Salvatierra. It's translated by Javier O. Huerta. The title of the poem is called Leon Salvatierra Was Born the Day They Killed Somoza. Somoza is an allusion to the Nicaraguan dictator, the clan, if you will, who ruled Nicaragua with an iron fist from the 1930s when the U.S. Marines put him in power until 1979 when the Somoza was overthrown. So just by naming that, I think he's already making this poem slightly political. But it's a beautiful, beautiful poem. Leon Salvatierra was born the day they killed Somoza. I was born the day they killed Somoza at 10:30 in the morning. Like gun smoke, the news spread through the streets of my barrio. I had been born with great gusto, so they named me Augusto. There were celebrations and toasts in my name. I was born the day they killed Somoza. My parents had already lost 5 children. I had lost 5 brothers. But I came out into the light healthy. Eyes, neither one inflamed. Arms, neither one fractured. 2 legs free of blemishes and sores. My small fingers, one by one, were complete. My fingernails, intact. My skin, red with wrinkles. But time knows that I was trapped in my mother's womb. I was born without crying, it's true. The umbilical cord was strangling me, but nothing was damaged. My fists and feet moved like fruit in tropical branches. My parents cried for me. They say everyone could see it in their faces. Well, I was happy news. I was born the day they killed Somoza. In my mind, it's an example of a political poem without the sloganeering.
Yes.
It's so subtle because those of us who are familiar with the Somoza dictatorship know that he tortured political prisoners, etc. And just that wonderful, you know, talking about eyes, neither one inflamed, yes. Arms, neither one fractured, yes. My fingernails intact. Yes. It's like he's subtly alluding to this regime, but without hitting you over the head with it.
Yeah.
And implicitly saying the day they killed Somoza, because after he was deposed, he was assassinated in Paraguay, I think. It was this bazooka just blew up his car. He was assassinated, basically. But he's not, it's a poem that on the one hand seems to be celebrating that day, the day of the speaker's birth, but it's also the day that the dictator was, you know, got what was coming to him, basically. Yes. But he does it in a very subtle way, by talking about the day of his birth. There's also, he mentions, and so they named me Augusto. That's a reference to Augusto Sandino, who's the person after whom the Sandinistas were named. So it's a beautiful example of, I think, of a political poem, but without being overtly political.
Sure.
It's lyric.
But you get it. What I was getting from that is exactly after the dictator dies, here I come. right? 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 And I'm not wounded. I'm not shot. My legs are not broken. My eyes aren't gouged out. It's basically, this is the damage that he did to our people, right? Right? Yes. And the victory of me is that, you know, he's gone. This allows me to have the space to be me, you know, unwounded, free. This seems to be a push for backsliding and amnesia in literature. And that really worries the out of me. Fast forwarding from where we entered the story to where we are now, you can do exactly the opposite with just what's going on right now. If you start removing people, removing stories and suppressing stories,
removing authors from reading lists and stuff.
That's right. And you move forward another 25 years, what do you get in the next 25 years? What does that culture look like? What does that literature look like? I think we need to intervene as much as we possibly can. And I'm glad the radio show is hopefully doing some of that. And also you coming to visit the class would be wonderful for this. It's really worrisome, you know? So thank you. This has been so much fun. Thanks for stopping by to Open House for this conversation with Francisco Aragon. The music for this episode is written and performed by my bands, Cornelius Edie Trio and Bow and Verse. The program is produced by Poets House and edited by Nick Buffon. Join us next week for more poetry and conversation. See you at the house.
Listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI New York with a moment in women's history.
The real issue is repression against anyone who is exercising what we say are our constitutional rights of freedom of speech.
Ella Baker, co-founder of the Christian Leadership Conference to Fight Racism and the inspiring force behind SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, after the Greensboro, North Carolina lunch counter sit-ins. Along with CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, SNCC organized the 1961 Freedom Rides and in 64 Freedom Summer to register black voters in Mississippi. Baker says marches are necessary to dramatize injustice, but asks why march to Washington?
Why not march to Long Island? Why not march to Westchester? Why not march to the slums of New Jersey? Why not march to Harlem, to Bedford-Stuyvesant? Not in terms of a physical march, but in terms of recognizing that what is happening in these places in terms of poverty is a responsibility that has to be dealt with by those who are not impoverished. In other words, those of us who have money have got to speak to those who are in power.
Ella Baker says voting is the key. The Ella Baker Center for Human Rights Today advocates for books, not bars, jobs, not jails, healthcare, not handcuffs. You can hear more Ella Baker and other trailblazers from WBAI's Women's History Collection by becoming a WBAI buddy, a sustaining member of WBAI. $15 a month makes you a sustaining member, a WBAI buddy. You'll receive our extensive Women's History Collection plus WBAI's tote bag, and we'll throw in a special gift. Please call 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950 to become a WBAI buddy in the name of your favorite WBAI program or in the name of all WBAI shows. 212-209-2950. We're looking for more people to become WBAI buddies. 212-209-2950. Or please go to this website, women.wbai.org, women.wbai.org, to become a WBAI buddy on this Women's History Day.
In a voice,
and I must be heard.
I must difficult.
WBAI Community Advisory Board meeting is on Sunday, March 19th at 1 p.m. You are invited to attend. The CAB or CAB is